All right, welcome into another episode of the Vertical Podcast, and we've got a great show for you today. Vinny Del Negro, he joins me right off the top, and it was an interesting conversation with Vinny because we discussed what the Raptors needed, and then in the middle of the podcast, we found out the Raptors got somebody, Serge Ibaka. That deal went down. Vinny and I broke that down and discussed how Ibaka could positively impact the Toronto Raptors.
Gives him more rim protection. He can stretch the floor. He's a pick-and-pop guy. He has experience. He can switch pick and rolls. Big guys that can switch pick and rolls, that can contain a guard to shoot jump shots, is obviously vital, and Serge can do that. So I love it.
Later, I check in with Greg Anthony, a former New York Knick, a former teammate of Charles Oakley, and I get Greg's take on the ongoing drama between the Knicks and their former player.
I thought Mr. Dolan and the organization completely dropped the ball. That was a lose-lose situation for them, with the emphasis on lose.
And don't forget, if you like this podcast, go to iTunes, give us a rating, leave us a comment. It helps the podcast grow, and you know that I appreciate it. All right, let's jump right in. We begin this week's show going around the league a little bit. Some issues in Toronto, Washington playing great basketball, and Miami. Have they found something in Dion Waiters, of all people? We'll talk about that and a whole lot more. Bringing Vinny Del Negro, former NBA coach, now NBA analyst, NBA TV, and he joins me here on the podcast. Let's start in Toronto, Vinny, because the Raptors right now, they're a mess. I mean, they're losing games, and if you're trying to read between the lines with Kyle Lowry saying these days, it sounds like there's some internal dissension with the Raptors. When you watch them, what are you seeing?
Inconsistency, obviously. I mean, they've had such a great run for such a long time here. They haven't had the success in the playoffs that, you know, their record would dictate. But overall, I mean, that backcourt has been dynamic. You know, DeRozan's been out with some injuries, so that kind of threw a little wrench in it. But, you know, I'm a big believer in trusting your eyes. When it looks right, it looks right. And Toronto's had a lot of great moments, but lately they've been slipping a little bit, and you know, they're fifth in the East right now, and they're 4-6 in their last 10. But you know, you got to take the highs and the lows through the season. They're all not going to be easy games. It's hard to win in this league, and especially when your key guys are injured, you got to kind of manage that as best you can. So Toronto will be dangerous come playoff time, but you know, I don't like kind of with that talent level where they're at. But I think Dwayne Casey and his staff do a good job. They've been there. They know the system, but the inconsistency obviously is a concern.
Yeah, and look, I'm not ready to write off Toronto yet either. What I am concerned about is the defense. And, you know, they were a top 11 defense last year. They're 19th or 20th this year. I mean, the only guy they really lost of consequence was Bismack Biyombo. And he was a good playoff producer, but it's not like he was a massive rotation player last year. I mean, where do you see the drop-off in this team defensively?
Well, they kind of were here a couple of years ago. You know, they struggled defensively, and then they got it back a little bit last year. And then, like I said, it's been a little bit inconsistent this year. They score a lot of points, but they're giving up, you know, like a lot of points as well for that team. Valanciunas obviously is a different player than Biyombo. Biyombo was more of a rim protector at times, but, Valanciunas continues to improve. But, you know, rim protection, they have a lot of kind of same size, versatile athletes when you're looking at a DeRozan and you're looking at a Ross and you're looking at some of the guys, the Carrolls on the wing. So, you know, they switch pick and rolls, they do some things, but at the end of the day, it has to be a collective effort defensively. And not only that, rebound the ball, because once they get the rebound and they can slow people down, they're explosive in the open court. When Lowry's pushing it, DeRozan, Valanciunas is going down the middle, Carroll can spot up. So they have weapons. But you know, they're going to be a dangerous playoff team. I mean, they've finished in the top two or three the last few years and haven't really, done a great job in the playoffs in terms of where they think they can from a record standpoint. Maybe this is the year where they kind of, you know, fall in that 4-5 spot and then they end up doing something special in the playoffs, because they're more than capable. We know that.
Yeah. I mean, to me, there's got to be a sense of urgency there just because Kyle Lowry's about to turn 31. You know, you're going to pay him a lot of money this offseason. And even though DeRozan's younger, you know, I just don't see Toronto as in the same position as like a Boston or a Milwaukee or even a Washington at this point. The core of their team and Lowry in particular, you know, this is the time where I think they've got to try to find a way to make a deal because they can't wait out Cleveland. These other teams can wait out Cleveland. I don't think Toronto can.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, you know, age has a lot to do with it. Contracts, there's a lot of flexibility. And with teams now with the TV money coming in, but at the end of the day, some of these guys demanding certain salaries and things. And you're absolutely right. Boston's young. Washington with that young backcourt, they're just playing tremendous. You know, and Milwaukee's got a young core. Very, very sad to, you know, see Parker's injury. You know, I feel terrible for him, but he was having a tremendous year for the Bucks. But you got to deal with it. You got to move on. You got to, you know, he'll get back. But there's a lot of teams in limbo. But like you said, I think you're absolutely right. You know, teams can't wait on Cleveland. And Boston and Washington are teams with some young pieces that can wait. But, you know, I think Cleveland's going to be there for a while. LeBron James isn't going anywhere.
Put a Paul Millsap on the Raptors right now and take off, say, you know, Terrence Ross. Take off Terrence Ross and Norman Powell, just for the sake of argument. How much better, or are they better, with Millsap minus those two other players?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think Millsap is a versatile player. What he can do is he can, if you put a big guy on him, he can stretch the floor, can open the floor up for DeRozan and obviously Lowry. He's an all-star. And then if you put someone small on him, he has the versatility. You can run your offense through him at the elbow. He can shoot the basketball. I mean, I'm a big Millsap guy. I think he gives the versatility the way the game is played now. He would give any team, you know, a boost because of his versatility.
Yeah, and they don't have that right now. That's for sure. At that four spot. I just wonder how aggressive they're going to be. I mean, that what I said there, the Powell and Ross, those are, that's a big price, especially when you're talking about young players there for a, you know, a 31-year-old Millsap, where you're gonna have to pay $100+ million at the end of the year. But I mean, maybe this, you know, maybe it is desperation time. Maybe it is like kind of roll the dice time.
You nailed it. I mean, at the end of the day, now is their time. And if you sit back and look at, are they better with Millsap or those two other guys? And I like Ross and I like Powell, but at the end of the day, I think when it comes down to the playoffs and your rotation and you're trying to make a splash now because of the age, maybe if I'm Boston or Washington or whatever, and I have to give up too much, maybe I don't do it right now. But a Toronto team, like you said, maybe they have to look at that a little bit harder because of that situation, to bring in a guy they feel that gives them the best chance right now.
Are these the days that, you know, the weeks before the All-Star break and the trade deadline, as a coach, are these the days that you kind of, you know, have to dig deep and find ways to motivate guys because they know they've got a break coming up? It's been, you know, 3 long months. I mean, when do those, quote, dog days kind of start for NBA teams?
I think it varies. I think it varies a couple things on injuries, on schedule, on, you know, how your team's playing. I mean, during the holidays, during the All-Star break, if your teams can find a way to stay focused and stay in the moment, have at least a little bit of good practice time, depending on if the schedule breaks, you know, I think you can take advantage of it. Some teams do a better job than others, but you know, you're going to play 82 regular season games and they're all going to add up at the end. So you can't afford to give any away. Win the ones that you need to win, protect your home court. But at the end of the day, you know, some of these younger teams, they'll struggle because of inconsistency, because of inexperience. The veteran teams seem to plod along because they know what it takes and how they can win basketball games. It's not always about playing your best. It's about playing the most consistent basketball you can. And the teams that do that are the guys that kind of just go about, they're never too high, they're never too low. They understand it's the length of the season, and they handle their business when need be.
And the problem Toronto's running into this year is that it's not just Cleveland they're kind of looking up at now. It's Boston and it's Washington. And I want to start with Washington there and just the unbelievable stretch of games that they've been on over the last. I mean, they started off, what, 2-8 or something like that, and over the last 2 months, they've been as good as anybody in basketball. What impact have you seen a guy like Scott Brooks had on this team? And what, where are they, you know, considerably better than maybe they were last year?
Well, first thing is obviously when you bring in a new coach, it's going to take a while for guys to adapt to the system, how they want to do things defensively, what play sets offensively. You know, the coach and his staff are going to implement those things in practice, in training camp, as best as possible. Early on, they were trying to find their way, and you could see, you know, whenever you're thinking too much on the court, your feet get slow. It's a reaction game. You have to be able to react. And as the season has gone on, that backcourt of Wall and Beal has been so dynamic. They're playing with such a nice flow to their game. They know John Wall and Beal are playing as good of a backcourt as anybody in the league. Wall's pushing that basketball, Beal scoring at a high clip, and Beal is healthy. He's had so many injuries to knock him back. He's been pretty consistent from that standpoint, and they've really just taken off. But I think Otto Porter's performance, I think Gortat around the basket, I think Morris gives them that stretch four, so it opens the court up for Beal, and Wall. You know, I think Washington's issue is continually to try to find consistent play off their bench. Mm. If they can continually find consistent play off their bench with that backcourt and the weapons they have, they're going to be a problem. It's just the way they're playing right now. The court is more open for John. He's playing fantastic, and we know how difficult to cover Beal is.
Have you seen, I can't really tell per se, and Scott's been adamant that, you know, coaching John Wall is not like coaching Russell Westbrook, even though they both kind of have some, you know, sort of similar characteristics there. But are you seeing, when you watch Wall play, any shades of the way that Scott played Westbrook in Oklahoma City?
Well, people will compare from a standpoint of, you're talking about, you know, Westbrook and Wall, two of the best athletes we have at that position, and not only that position, but in the whole league. I mean, Westbrook is incredible athletically, his energy and unbelievable. John Wall in the open court or in pick and rolls can blow by and get to the rim and finish over the top of big guys. I mean, they're just special athletes. So from that aspect, I'm sure, you know, breaking a defense down or whatever, Wall, you know, is looking to pass a little bit more. You know, Russell is obviously a score first point guard. With me, when I look at point guards, to me, it's not only the production, but how do they play in the biggest moments? And what is their turnover ratio compared to assist to turnovers? And, you know, Russell can get out of control. He puts up eye-popping, incredible stats, and he's playing phenomenal. But John has done a better job, I think, just kind of controlling his team from that aspect in a way of a real point guard. But I love watching Westbrook. I think John Wall has taken his game to another level. And that's why you see Washington third in the East.
Yeah, I always thought one of the more underrated parts of Scott's sort of coaching their sort of portfolio there has been his ability to kind of communicate with players and gravitate towards them. I thought he had strong relationships with Westbrook and Durant for a while in Oklahoma City, and I feel like he's taken that sort of bond, built some trust with Wall and Beal. I mean, how important is it for a coach to you want to be close with all your players, but when you have your alphas there, your stars, how important is it to establish, you know, that kind of trust early?
Oh, it's vital, especially in today's game. There's no question about it. I mean, and you can see it in their games. There is a trust factor. There's I don't want to say a freelance, but a flow and a confidence to the way they're playing. So Scott's going to let his guys play. He did that with Durant and Westbrook. He's obviously doing it with his backcourt. And I think guys appreciate that, but also having the ability to gain trust and have a relationship where you have to still be able to coach these guys. I mean, you still have to be able to, you know, say, what were you thinking here? Let's watch film. All right, we got a 2-for-1 here. Whatever the situation is, there's a lot of quick decisions that have to be made. They're not always going to go perfect, but over time, you can work on those things and practice in film sessions and shoot-arounds and then try to execute better in the game. So it's about the experiences. It's about the time. And really, it's about helping guys develop individually to make the core of the team and the star players especially help the other players become better. It's about improving every day, having that mentality. And I think the Wizards kind of went through that early on, and I think they're kind of found their stride. And guess what? Now they have a lot of confidence. They know the style of play they want. They know what they can do defensively. They can switch things with those 1, 2, and 3 guys because John Wall has that versatility with his size. So it disrupts offenses. And once they got in the open court, they're going to score the basketball.
So, Vinny, as we speak, and this is the beauty of the podcast here, we have a trade with Toronto. In fact, they have acquired Serge Ibaka from the Magic in exchange for Terrence Ross and a 2017 first-round pick. I know this is kind of happening in real time, but your initial reaction to that deal?
Love it. I think Serge Ibaka gives him more rim protection. He can stretch the floor. He's a pick-and-pop guy. He has experience. He can switch pick and rolls. Big guys that can switch pick and rolls, that can contain a guard to shoot jump shots, is obviously vital, and Serge can do that. So I love it. I mean, I think it's great for Toronto. I know there's been some different things with Ibaka in the last couple weeks, and I think exactly what we were just talking about. I think there's a sense of urgency in Toronto, and they're going to go after it now, and I think Serge is obviously a great pickup.
Yeah, I like it too. And as I look at the price, I mean, Terrence Ross, it's a young player, pretty good. The 17 first round pick is probably going to be in the 20s somewhere. So
right.
Yeah, even though it's perceived to be a deep draft, I like that too. And clearly Toronto's going to have to make some kind of financial investment in Ibaka, who's going to be a free agent at the end of the year looking for a big time contract. But I guess if you're the Raptors, like we were talking about, now's the time. You're going to pay guys. You pay them all now.
Yeah, and if you don't think it's going to work, then you move them on or whatever. You do a sign and trade, or you figure it out. But I think exactly what we were just talking about, they're slipping. They know they need some help. They can get more rim protection. And when you can grab a guy like Serge, obviously, he's definitely going to help them. There's no question.
Does this deal, I mean, how much closer does this pull Toronto or Cleveland? Because that's ultimately what the bar is going to be.
I think it definitely helps. I think, I want to see it first, but I can picture it. And obviously he has the versatility to definitely help them. So, the thing is I don't think, obviously Toronto is having a little bit of a bumpy road right now, but this trade could spark something really good for them. But at the end of the day, there's no one putting their hands up saying, oh, we'd love to play Toronto in the first round. I mean, DeRozan and Lowry are a problem. Valanciunas is approved. Now you look at a Serge Ibaka that can do some damage. I mean, Damari Carroll can hit some shots and he'll get after you defensively. So, hey, Toronto will, they'll figure it out here, and they're going to be a tough out, I think, with the experience that we talked about.
Yeah. The more I look at that deal and process it, I like it a lot. Valanciunas and Ibaka, I think, can be complementary with Ibaka's shooting. Experience matters. Ibaka's been deep into the postseason. It's a smart deal, I think, for Masai Ujiri, who's a terrific general manager. The other team kind of in that mix, Vinny, is Boston. They're playing great right now. Just finished a 3-1 road trip with a win at Dallas. I mean, they're scoring on everybody. I mean, that offense, Isaiah Thomas is the engine that drives it, but they're seventh overall in efficiency. That's not just IT. That's a lot of other guys that are producing there. I mean, when you see Boston, how they're playing offensively, what are you looking at?
Well, at first it starts with Isaiah. There's no question. I mean, he breaks the defense down. He's just a problem, especially in today's game with the pick and roll and his ability to shoot, floaters, everything else. But the thing about Boston, when you watch them, they're deep and they play hard. Marcus Smart is a tough player. When Bradley's healthy, he's obviously tough. Isaiah is a gritty little player. They have guys, I think, Olynyk stretches the defense for him. Amir Johnson knows his role in the team. I mean, the list goes on and on with these guys. And we know how good a player Horford is. With his experience and his versatility to run offense through him at the elbow. So, I mean, Boston just kind of plod along. And I think, Detroit being young and Chicago trying to figure out and Indiana, and Toronto struggling. I mean, Boston is just taking advantage, but they're playing well on the road. But they know who they are. When you watch them, they know who they are. And Isaiah Thomas in the fourth quarter has won them, I don't know how many games, but he's been the games I've watched. With him, he's been phenomenal in the fourth quarter, and that's where the game is played smarter, faster, and everything, and he's been able to take those games over on the offensive end and really put them over the top.
Yeah, the two things that worry me about Boston are defense and rebounding.
Sure.
And the defense is going to get better when Avery Bradley gets back in the lineup. The rebounding, I'm not so sure. I mean, that's where I think a team like Boston would benefit greatly if, say, an Andrew Bogut wriggled free from Dallas before the buyout deadline. I'm not so sure it's going to happen at this point with Dallas playing some pretty good basketball, but I still think they're a big away from contending. I just Al Horford's told me many times he's not a center. He doesn't want to be a center. He doesn't rebound well enough to be a center. I think if they wind up in a series with a physical team like a Toronto now, Valanciunas had 20-plus rebounds against the Celtics a couple of games back. Ibaka in that mix. Washington can play physical at times. I think that's kind of their Achilles heel right now.
I would agree with that. But the way the game is played now, not a lot of teams take advantage of it with the post-ups. But I do agree with extra possessions and rebounding the basketball. But if the Celtics can rebound the ball at a high clip, when they get out in the open court with Isaiah, I mean, he is really difficult to contend with. We've seen that all year, being an all-star. The depth of the team, they just keep coming at you. They got to get Bradley healthy. They have to, and Danny Ainge will look at, obviously, any trade that he thinks can put him over the top. But right now they're playing such good basketball, 9-1 in their last 10. Their offense through Isaiah and the things they're doing, you have to like them. And I think exactly what you said before, they have a lot of one draft picks, but also they have a lot of young players, and they don't need to make any harsh decisions right now unless it's something they think puts them over the top. But right now, putting them over the top means they have to beat Cleveland and LeBron James, and that's a tall order for anybody, as we've seen the last 10 years or so in this league.
Yeah, I wouldn't be, if I'm the Celtics, I wouldn't be focused on getting past Cleveland this year. I mean, mortgaging the future with a draft pick, I know they're not going to give up one of those Brooklyn picks unless it's, you know, Paul George in return for it. But, you know, this is the kind of year where I think you focus on getting to the conference finals, you know, crawl before you walk in some ways and get there, and then, you know, take that Brooklyn pick, either use it or parlay it for a George or a Jimmy Butler or somebody that might be available more this offseason. This is kind of the year where the Celtics are, I'm going to get out of the first round and advance before I start worried about beating Cleveland.
Well, my thing is if you're talking about Paul George and Jimmy Butler, I think anytime you have an opportunity to get either one of those guys, you have to take a hard look at it, depending on who's on the other, you know, what the deal is exactly. But, I mean, you're talking about those guys are difference makers, and obviously you can't play everybody, you can't pay everybody, so having draft picks and young players is key. You have to manage it the right way, but you know, you can't replace talent, and Jimmy Butler and Paul George obviously put Boston in a stronger position.
Oh, if it was a straight, you know, Brooklyn pick this year, presuming it's 1, 2, or 3 for Jimmy Butler, I'd do that in a heartbeat. I think Butler's, you know, still a franchise type player who, you know, you put him and Isaiah on the same team, you're kind of off to the races. I would absolutely do that.
Well, and the thing is the draft this year, it's heavy in point guards. I mean, the top players are really point guards. So, you already have Isaiah, so why, you know, you don't need a point guard right now, and he's still very young. So, I mean, that you'd have to, you know, I'm sure Danny Ainge is taking a hard look at all that.
I agree with what you're saying there on, like, the whole point guard heavy. It's Fultz and it's Ball, the top two picks almost unquestionably in this draft. Although, whenever I say that, I always get this sort of, like, twinge in the back of my mind where it's like, you say that now, and what if Fultz turned out to be Russell Westbrook 2.0?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, well, we had a point guard, but
sounds really good right now, but then the kid turns into something different and some superstar. Yeah, but you know, those are the decisions you have to make in the front office that sometimes don't always go your way.
You've been part of draft processes before as a coach. I mean, how much emphasis do you put on, all right, we've got a guy at this position, so we're not going to take a guy at this position?
It varies. I mean, exactly what you said. I mean, if you're scouts and if you've gone and done your homework and you think a guy like Fultz or like Ball or one of these guys is going to be a superstar in the league and a franchise-changing player, then obviously that's going to change the way you go about it. But, you know, Boston's in such a strong position with the draft picks, with their young players, and any of those teams that you look at. But, you know, you're always balancing that, you know. Or, for example, you know, hey, if we go and take this kid in the draft, what can we get for, a player at that position on our roster right now? What's available out there? You know, can we get another good player and a pick in this year's draft or next year's draft? And, you know, you're trying to build and put the pieces together. I'm a firm believer in, when I was putting teams together, the biggest thing is make sure you get a guy that fills a position. A 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever it is, go get that best player, fill that position. And if you already have a really good young player at that position, make sure you use that to fill a position and get a quality starting player in the draft, in a trade or whatever, because eventually you build it up over that way through free agency and through draft and through development.
A couple of things I want to ask you about. Miami, you know, a month ago, they looked like a team that was, you know, almost a lock for a bottom five spot, top five type of pick. The last, you know, to a month or so, they've been, you know, one of the best teams in basketball. You know, you can attribute some of that to Deion Waiters, who's been largely terrific for them. I think Eric Spoelstra and that player development program down in Miami has been, you know, once again, really solid. But when you see Miami, where have you seen this kind of sudden growth?
I think what you said. Eric Spoelstra has done a fantastic job. There's no question about it. I mean, they could have went south, like you said, but they found a way to stick together. Deion Waiters is playing great in big moments. Dragic has found his way. We know Whiteside is a problem up front with his shot blocking and scoring. But I think when you watch them play, I think they kind of figured out who they are and how they need to play to win. And every team has a little bit of a different MO. You know, some teams can run their offense in the fourth quarter through superstars and get double teams and play off that. Other teams have to kind of figure it out collectively. You know, we talk about Boston, you know, the ball is going to be in Isaiah's hands. We talk about Cleveland, the ball is going to be in Kyrie and LeBron's hands. Well, you know, Dejan Waiters has been the guy, Dragic has been the guy, and they've shared it. But I'll tell you, I've been very impressed. They play hard. They know who they are, and they keep coming at you. So I give Miami a lot of credit, kind of the way they've turned things around. But more or less, the development, the confidence, the trust that seems like the team has is obviously going a long way. And I think you got to give Eric Spoelstra a lot of credit for that.
On a good team, what is Dejan Waiters?
On a good team?
Yeah.
He comes off the bench and you wind him up and you say, go crazy. Go get your, Vinny Johnson in Detroit, the microwave. Just give him the ball and let him go score. I mean, Dion needs the ball in his hands. He's good off the dribble. He can get his shot off with his hang dribble going left. He has range. So I think you just, you know, you let him go. You run some plays for him. If he's hot, you ride him. If he's not, you don't have to. So he's a weapon, though. He's proven that he's a weapon out there. Obviously, his play in Oklahoma City was different because the ball wasn't in his hands nearly as much because of who he was playing with. In Miami, he's getting the opportunity more. He's produced well, and he's helping them win games.
He would scare the crap out of me in the offseason. Just because, I mean, look, there's a Toronto, I mean, not Toronto, there's a Brooklyn, a Philadelphia, a handful of teams out there with all this cap space. Who would give him the kind of contract that I think would immediately make you think twice. I mean, I love what he's doing. Don't get me wrong, but
I agree.
This guy, the unpredictability of him and the need to be a volume shooter, that would scare me if I'm my. He's the kind of guy, in other words, I can see Miami kind of having a number they'll go to and not going any higher.
I would agree with that, but also you have to understand when I'm looking at it, I'm also looking at it from the standpoint of if you're going against Miami, you have to game plan when he comes in the game. So there's a value to that. So he's a quality player. You have to game plan some things against him if he gets going or things. So I look at that as well. I think Miami will take a hard look. I think exactly what you're saying, they'll go to a certain number, and there's going to be enough teams out there that are going to have some crazy type of deals available for guys when they strike out on their first picks.
All right, before I let you go, the one Western Conference question, and we know that Golden State is by far and away the top dog out there, San Antonio right behind them, but do you see Houston, which is only a few games back right now, the Spurs, do you see them as a legit contender in the West?
I think the way they've played, you have to. I mean, and the reason I say that is they from day one, you know, I went to training camp for a few days with them. Mike D'Antoni is a longtime friend and has done a fantastic job. From day one, they kind of figured it out from a style aspect of what Mike wanted. And I think Harden has been incredible, but I think everyone else is kind of bought in. They know who they are and how they need to win. Now, can they guard well enough to win? They're going to score the basketball. I mean, Harden is Eric Gordon, who I've coached, is having a fantastic season. He bought into coming off the bench because he can handle the ball more. He can do more things. So Ariza, I've always been a fan of his versatility. They're getting a lot of different production from a lot of different guys. But at the end of the day, it's Harden's show. And when you got a guy like him that can go and put in incredible amounts of points and control the game and pick and rolls and make everybody better, you know, with him, it's can he control his turnovers in the big moments? And can they execute in the big moments? And he's proven that they can. You know, you don't go 40-17 and not kind of be able to finish games off. The ball's in his hands a lot. So in a series, you're going to have to score and slow them down. And if you do, you'll beat them. But if you can't, that's going to be a problem. They have three-point shooters. They have versatility. They can stretch you out. So Harden, the superstar players will control that in the playoffs. And he's obviously one of the tops in the league.
Yeah, the question is, can they defend?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Can they get inside that, you know, top 15, top 12? If they
are
they
going to play a team that's going to jump shoot, miss, and get long rebounds, and they're on the open court? I mean, they can explode offensively, or is it a team that's going to kind of control the pace against them and try to take some possessions away, trap Harden, and make other guys beat you? And you know, you're going to make adjustments in the playoffs and change things up. But at the end of the day, if they defend and if they can control their defensive glass, they're going to score the basketball.
Yeah. And what, you know, speaking of Mike D'Antoni real quick, he's, I mean, this is kind of resurgence for him, and I feel I'm glad for him. I mean, he's been kind of embattled in his last two stops, and now he's got a team that can play his style, has bought into his style. I mean, for people that think that D'Antoni is kind of this sort of, you know, let's play rec league basketball.
No,
I agree with you. I mean, coaches tell me all the time, they steal stuff from Mike. They still steal stuff from Mike when he comes back in the league. I mean, what is behind the brilliance of his offensive philosophies?
He doesn't try to overcoach. He has a system that he believes in. He lets players believe in that. He puts them in areas of strength. It's a smooth system. Guys want to shoot. Guys want to score. Guys want to run. But there's also a commitment to that. It's very, oh, we want to run. We want to run. Well, guess what? It takes a lot of energy to run. Not today in this game probably as much. But guess what? You got three games in four nights or back-to-backs or whatever you got. There's a consistency and a style that he wants to play. He demands that they play that way. And guys eventually kind of learn that. But it all comes down to having, you know, he had obviously Steve Nash in Phoenix, who was a great player. Then he tried to play that style in New York, didn't have an orchestrator to do that. In LA, it was a different type of style. But now he can play his style that he likes coaching. He makes everybody feel good. They can shoot threes. He lets them play. But he also keeps guys accountable, and he has a system that is, I don't want to say simple, but it makes the players feel like, man, we can do this. And they having a great player like Harden takes a lot of pressure off everybody. And the system is obviously working in Houston. You got to give Mike a lot of credit for it.
Yeah, you do. And I think he's the coach of the year right now. Vinny, always great to catch up with you, man. I appreciate taking some time to join the podcast here.
Anytime, buddy. Good to talk to you.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Hi, boys and girls. It's Tony Kornheiser reminding you to subscribe and listen to my daily podcast, where we talk about everything from sports to politics to the impending animal revolution. And remember, you can listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play.
All right, joining me now is Greg Anthony, former NBA player, NBA analyst for NBA on TNT and NBA TV. You can check out the all-new Art of the Triple-Double series across NBA TV, NBA.com, and social media. NBA TV and TNT, of course, are your comprehensive TV homes for coverage of NBA All-Star 2017 from New Orleans, beginning on Thursday at 8 p.m. All right, Greg, I want to get to a bunch of stuff with you here, but I want your reaction to the news that broke this afternoon on Serge Ibaka. He is headed to Toronto in exchange for Terrence Ross and a first-round pick. What do you think of that deal?
You know, on the surface, I do like it if you're Toronto. Listen, Quentin Ross is a young player that I think has a lot of potential. But in a lot of ways, right now, he's more of a specialist. With Serge, you get a guy that can also stretch the floor, but he gives you some more frontline defense. Another guy who can maybe be more of a consistent scorer, because that's the one thing that this group right now, Toronto, lacks. They don't have a third guy that on any given night can carry them offensively. And while Serge is not a guy that you're going to throw it to 30 times a night, he's not that kind of a offensive load carrier. He is a guy that can consistently put up points. He's proven, you know, he's played on some really good teams deep in the postseason, been in the finals, and he's still a relatively young player. So long term, this could be a really good move. But ultimately, and you know this, Chris, it all comes down to, is it enough to get him over the hump? Is it really truly enough if Cleveland's good to beat Cleveland? That I don't think so. But I do think potentially it's an improvement for their team.
Yeah, and I like the deal, Greg, because it's logical. You know, Ibaka makes some sense there as a floor spacing kind of big. He's got experience. And he's only 27 years old. So, yeah, you're going to have to pay him, but you're also going to have to pay Kyle Lowry anyway. You didn't have cap space regardless. So now you have the bird rights to Ibaka to bring him back and add him to the fold. I mean, you know, this is, you know, kind of a vintage Masai Ujiri type of move. And, you know, the 17 pick is tough because this draft looks pretty good. But if that pick is in the mid-20s, who gives a damn at this point? I mean, I'm big on this deal.
Yeah. The only thing I'd caution on any draft, and we've seen it in the past, guys do fall. And in a draft where you have as much impact coming from the really young players, there's more of an opportunity to get a really quality player later because there's more of an unknown commodity with guys that are this young. You know, having said that, I'm with you too, because you're not going to have the cap space, so you're not going to really participate in the free agent market. And the reality is this also, no matter where you pick in this year's draft, for the most part, none of those guys are transformational, meaning nobody's coming in and making a significant impact on your team today. They're not going to get you over the hump if you're trying to legitimately win a championship. And I think from that standpoint is where, if you're Toronto, you have to say this deal is probably our best chance to get better. It allows us to win now, but still keeps us relevant for several years moving forward.
Yeah, and it's not just Toronto, or not just Cleveland anymore that Toronto has to worry about. I mean, you watch the way Washington's playing this year, the way Boston's playing right now. I mean, you know, they're in a dogfight. I mean, they could be a second-round team and out if you're the Raptors. I mean, which of the two teams that I just mentioned, Boston and Washington, I mean, which is the bigger threat right now to make a move in the East?
Oof, man. You know, I would have to say I trust Boston more for two reasons. One, they've been better longer, and they have, I think, in a roster and in a front office, people who I just would have to say, again, I trust a little more. Mm-hmm. You know, Danny's been in a similar situation before and was able to put together deals that got him a world championship. The next level that is, they've also shown that they can basically go out and sign an A-list free agent, which prior to this past offseason, you'd never seen happen before in Boston. Mm-hmm. You know, all the big-time talents they either drafted or they traded for. So that opens up another element for them moving forward. Now, Washington's been terrific. Scott Brooks deserves a tremendous amount of credit for what he's done there. But that roster is still limited right now, right? They got the two guys who I think are phenomenal right now. I think in terms of Beal and Wall, I think Otto Porter is really coming into his own. And he's a perfect example of my point about the other guys, the young guys coming in the draft. You know, 2 years ago, people thought Otto Porter was a bust, right?
Mm.
You know,
now he's a max guy maybe in this offseason.
Yeah, yeah. Now, but it shows you the importance of getting a guy, getting him in your system, and allowing him to develop at his pace. And I think now Washington is being rewarded. The problem with Washington is the depth is a concern and the flexibility of the roster. Because, listen, I think that Boston and Toronto, as presently constructed in a seven-game series, and that's where sometimes we lose sight of this stuff. In a regular season, to beat anybody on any given night, honestly, the way they're playing, I might go Washington today. But looking ahead in a seven-game series, I still probably trust both Toronto and Boston a little bit more, and especially when you look at the ways in which they can beat you. There's just more flexibility. Remember, Boston's doing all this without Avery Bradley.
Mm.
You know, getting him back into the fold is going to make a huge difference for their roster, and they still have probably the best opportunity to make a move that could be significant before we get to the trade deadline.
You know what I love about Boston and Washington is that they hate each other. I think more teams, and you can appreciate this, of course, we need more teams, Greg, that hate each other. I was at the Oklahoma City game the other night with Golden State, and obviously they hate each other. Boston, Washington hate each other. More hate in the NBA. That's what we need.
Well, I'm with you. I think the problem, though, is that hate has to be a two-way street. And listen, a lot of teams hate the Warriors and the Cavs, but they just aren't in a position to beat them. When you look at Washington and Boston, these are two teams that feel like they're both better than the other, you know, and there's a more of a comparable matchup. And so that's where you create the rivalry, you know. And I agree with you. Listen, I told people this when they all decided the Wizards to wear black to that game, it showed me a lot about their locker room, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, the two games that John Wall has pointed to and said, these are big games, talked about it publicly, two best games they probably played all season, even though they lost the game to the Cavs and then that game against Boston. I mean, that stuff's important in terms of building trust and cohesion in that locker room. And those two teams are playing really good basketball, arguably better right now than even the Cavs. But again, big picture, I don't think they're quite there. But again, you just never know. And again, look at Cleveland's uncertainty from an injury standpoint with all that's going on there. you know, it's just never a guarantee that they're going to be completely right when the time comes.
Speaking of trust and cohesion, Charles Oakley and James Dolan singing Kumbaya together at the Olympic Tower. I mean, you're an ex-Nick. You're a teammate of Oakley. Yeah. Just your general sense of what's gone on over the last week.
Well, I thought Mr. Dolan and the organization completely dropped the ball. There's no doubt about it. I've said so. There was a lose-lose situation for them. And with the emphasis on lose. I mean, that was a catastrophic failure. And, you know, there's just no rationale behind the action. And then you could almost see that there was some panic there, because then they rush and put out a statement that they couldn't validate or verify. Dolan comes out. When have you ever seen Dolan coming out and making the rounds?
Never.
To do PR. So all that stuff told you they knew. In this case, they at least knew they'd screwed up, right? I mean, because generally, one thing, and I've said this about Dolan, he doesn't really care about PR. You know, he's never really been one to go out and try to win over the public. But this is a time where, you know what, I think internally, a lot of people whom he probably trusts told him, you effed up. Mm. You know, you really screwed up on this one. You got to make this right. And now he's got an opportunity not only to make it right, but to maybe endear himself and get some goodwill out of this. Obviously, it's going to help if the team can improve. But that was just a huge mistake. And Charles, a close friend of mine, and I've talked to him on several occasions since this thing has gone down. And he was, it takes a lot to hurt Oak, a lot. He was really hurt by this. And I'm really thrilled to see the commissioner, Michael Jordan, those guys get involved, because they knew how important this was. But I also, I'm going to tell you, knowing Mr. Dolan from afar, I'm glad to see that he actually acknowledged and wanted to try to make this thing right. Because again, we've seen it before where, you know what, he just doesn't give a damn.
Yeah.
And whether it's the right thing or not, he's going to do what he wants to do. And in this case, for once, I really felt like he did the right thing. And I think you're going to see that play out moving forward.
I mean, can you believe he brought Sprewell back? I remember the first game Sprewell played back there, Greg, where he was, I mean, I was there. He was cursing Dolan out. He was making shots and he's cursing Dolan out on the sideline. I mean, it was surreal. And now all of a sudden it's like, come on back, Latrell, sit next to me.
Yeah. Kumbaya, you know, BFFs, you know, and all that stuff. And again, it just shows you how out of touch they were in this respect. And listen, first of all, to do it, was there anything more disingenuous than that entire thing playing out?
They called Vin Baker. Vin Baker. I didn't even know Vin Baker played for the Knicks.
Yeah. Right. Well, they were desperate trying to figure, again, it's, and part of the reason why is because they've never been in this situation before. You think about all the circumstances that have played out over the last 15 years. And with all the negative that's come out, they've never really felt obligated to justify their actions, right? They've never gone and tried to win the PR battle. And so, and this is what happens when you don't have an idea of how to do it. They had no clue, because all of that could have been resolved. All they had to do was reconcile, right? Think about it. All this stuff that they were doing was insignificant. So all they had to do was own up, reach out, and have this play out before all this stuff did. And all would have, I'm not going to say it would have been forgotten, but it would have been forgiven. And they could have, and more importantly, they could have brought Charles back into the fold, because in a lot of ways, he has been ostracized and alienated. I mean, listen, it's not like they've done a lot to reach out to arguably the greatest Knick of all time and Patrick Ewing. So they, you know, they've done themselves a lot of disservices over the past several years. But I do at least commend them for, you know, whether it was forced or, and I can't say it's forced, because hell, can't nobody force Dolan to do anything he doesn't want to do.
No.
But I'm just glad that cooler heads prevail and they've done the right thing by allowing, trying to put this thing to bed.
He would never do this, Greg, but can you imagine while Oakley's being like pulled out by eight guys, if Dolan walked over there, broke it up and said, Charles, come sit next to me, I mean, think about the way he would have been perceived if he did that.
Yeah, but part of probably why he wasn't is he's the guy that was the one that asked for Charles to put out, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a situation, it'd be hard to do that because, you know, eight guys aren't coming over there unless somebody way up the food chain said this had to be done. And remember, they did it during the game. I mean, live action was going on.
Yeah.
You know, early in the game, like, it just, they dropped the ball, you know, in a big, big way on this one. And it's unfortunate. And now they're paying the price. And hopefully they're going to learn a very valuable lesson from this moving forward.
I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in Adam Silver's office when he's got to talk to a 61-year-old man and a 53-year-old man and use Michael Jordan as a friggin' intermediary to get them to behave. I mean, it's just surreal to kind of look at. But, you know, look, one of the things that came out of the initial interview that Dolan did that kind of got looked over was, you know, he's basically saying that Phil Jackson is still fully in charge, that he's going to finish out his contract at the very least. And, you know, he's basically fine with whatever it is that Phil does. What did you make of that part of the interview?
Well, this is where, and I've always been in a minority on this, where I agree with him. And let me preface it by saying this. And Chris, you follow this stuff as well as anybody. If you go back and use some revisionist history and look at all the hires that James Dolan has made at the moment he made the hire, and not one of them would you have said was a bad hire.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wasn't a bad hire when he hired Larry Brown, was it? Like, did anybody jump off the mountaintop saying, oh, this is horrible, we can't do this?
No.
You know, this is going to set us back. Hell no. And it's really been like that for the most part for all of his hires. Nobody, when Phil Jackson was hired, was anybody screaming, this is a horrible decision?
Well, I'll tell you.
It'd be a coup.
I'll tell you, Greg, I wrote at the time I didn't like it, mostly because if you've got $12 million and you're going to give it to somebody, at the very least, you go to Masai Ujiri, Sam Presti, and R.C. Buford and ask them if they take it. If they don't want it, then you give it to Phil Jackson. But the best GMs in basketball, try them first.
Chris, there's no way that you were going to get, like, you got to have some, there's no reality for those guys to take that situation. You know, because at the end of the day, you're only as good as your best player. And all those guys that you just talked about, they all basically had great situations. So you're asking them to leave a really bad situation. I mean, a great situation to come to a really bad one where there's more uncertainty. And those guys are all smart. My point with Phil is, listen, you can say that you may not have been on board, but mm-hmm. let's look at what were the options, barring the fact that you couldn't get those guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there might have been a chance to get Masai, but realistically, I don't think you could have gotten any of those guys. And we're talking New York. We're talking a guy who's won 11 championships as a coach, 2 as a player, and he was a part of the last championship team you had as an organization. And so from a PR standpoint as well, and listen, whether you like him or not, we can't doubt his basketball acumen.
Sure.
You know, you just can't. And all I'm saying is, whether you agree with it, you couldn't say it was a horrible move or a bad move. Now, if he were able to get RC or Sam or Masai, absolutely. I would have had more confidence in those. But you and I both know the Lakers had a better chance of signing Kevin Durant last year
mm-hmm.
than that happened.
Yeah.
Right? Let's just be real. That wasn't going to happen.
I mean, look, and you know this, you're around the league in the sense of it's become a global game. I just don't know that a guy like Phil Jackson, even with his physical limitations of what he can do. I mean, these guys that I mentioned, the Masais and the Prestis, you know, they're on planes all the time scouring the globe for talent. Like, they're out there identifying these guys. And I just don't know if that, as smart as Phil Jackson is, and nobody's questioning his basketball acumen, of course not, but as smart as he is, this is a young man's game nowadays.
Yes.
And you've got to be willing to grind to be successful.
Now that I agree with you 100%. And part of the issues I had, again, I still had no issue with the hire, but my thought process was that he was also going to surround himself with people who had the acumen about the state of the game today. And that's where I think if you could point to where he's really failed, it's been in those areas. You know, and that's where, like, I had no issue with the trade for Derrick Rose, per se, because you know, it's not really costing you a whole lot, but the risk, the upside is worth the risk. You know, the Noah trade signing was a concern, because that's a big commitment to a guy that hadn't been a factor in a few years, and he's proven not to be much of a factor this year. So the moves he's made subsequently are, without question, ones you have to question. And I think a lot of that falls on the fact that they don't have, again, I don't think that their whole infrastructure in terms of how they view the game globally is necessarily completely intact. Now, the Porzingis deal, for me, I thought he was the second best player in that draft, right? So I didn't, they basically fell into him. You know, it wasn't as if they pulled off the coup per se, but I still give them credit for making the draft. But again, you know, if the Lakers had done what they were probably supposed to do, he wouldn't have been available. And then you really could have found this franchise in a huge issue, a huge problem moving forward. Yeah, even bigger than it is now. Because as bad as it is, you know, they can still salvage this season, realistically. You know, it's not as if they have no chance to make the playoffs, which I don't care what you say, would be a positive when you look at all that's transpired for that organization.
Yeah, it would be a positive. It's kind of a Band-Aid and a bullet hole in some ways, because they do have deep-seated issues that they've got to address moving forward. But that brings my last question. You know, as we approach the 23rd, if you're Phil Jackson, do you take the best offer just to get Carmelo off the roster and end this drama? Or are you holding out for something really significant? And if you don't get it, you keep Carmelo for the foreseeable future?
Well, two things. One, he doesn't have any leverage, Phil Jackson. So it's not a matter of him taking the best offer.
Well, the best offer from the teams that Carmelo would go to.
Exactly. So in that respect, you consider it. But I also look at it from this standpoint, too. The one other, not one, one, I think Carmelo's been a pretty damn good soldier throughout this, you know, because he's taken a lot of heat directly, indirectly, from internally, when you look at the organization, how they've gone about these subliminal messages and all this other stuff. The guy's played hurt, continues to grind and fight and lead. And when you look at that roster, with all the issues they've had, you can't question what he's brought to the table. Secondly, he's also allowing Kristaps Porzingis to not catch all the heat and get all these arrows, right? Because he's maybe not quite ready to be the face of the franchise. Mm-hmm. And so do you risk putting him out there to where now all this heat and all these arrows that Carmelo takes, he's going to start taking them, right? Because the expectations are going to grow. And so sometimes, you know, you got to allow his development to take priority in this situation. That's how I look at it. I feel like Carmelo has helped him in a lot of ways, because we don't focus on his struggles right now. You know, he still has some leeway. If Carmelo's not there, now his expectations have to rise. And whether he's ready or not, we don't know. We know the talent is there, the potential is there, but is he ready for that responsibility playing in New York City? That's something else you got to weigh when you look at this stuff. A lot of young players, oftentimes, guys give up on them too soon. And they end up realizing who they can become in other situations. You think back, remember Chauncey Billups? What is he, traded like 3 times?
Yeah.
Early in his career, thought to be a bust. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame one day. You know, more than likely. We just talked about Otto Porter and a lot of these guys. And so he's in a position where he's kind of able to develop at his own pace and not have the pressures or the weight of carrying a franchise. That can potentially go out the window if you pull the trigger on a Carmelo deal.
Never boring in New York, is it?
No, never. Not at all.
Hey, Greg, I know you're busy, man. I appreciate the time. Enjoy All-Star Weekend, and hopefully we'll catch up soon.
I look forward to it, man. All the best.
That's it for this week's show. My thanks to Vinny Del Negro and Greg Anthony for joining the podcast. Don't forget, you can check out Archive Podcasts on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.